Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Rodney Phillips, the curator of the Berg Collection of English and American Literature here at the library, and I'm pleased to welcome you to the talk between Michael Wood and Paul Auster tonight. Michael Wood, who will interview Paul Auster this evening, is the Charles Barnwell Strout Professor of English at Princeton University and director of the Christian Gauss Seminars in Criticism. He was a research fellow in French at St. John's College, taught English and comparative literature at Columbia University, and was professor of English at the University of Exeter in England. He is the author of Stendhal, America at the Movies, The Magician's Doubts, subtitled Nabokov and the Risks of Fiction, and the forthcoming Children of Silence, Studies in Contemporary Fiction, which will be published next spring. Professor Wood is a regular contributor to the London Review of Books and the New York Review of Books and has written many articles on film and literature and other matters for Harper's, The New Republic, The New York Times Book Review, and The Times Literary Supplement. Paul Auster has been hailed as one of our intellectually stimulating fiction writers, and his eight novels are canonical reading for devotees of American literature worldwide. His novels are Leviathan, which was awarded the 1993 Prix Medici, The Music of Chance, which was nominated for the 1991 Penn Faulkner Award, Moon Palace, Mr. Vertigo, In the Country of Last Things, and the three very, very wonderful novels known as the New York Trilogy, City of Glass, Ghosts, and The Locked Room. Mr. Auster has also written several volumes of poetry, a memoir, The Invention of Solitude, and a collection of essays, The Art of Hunger. He was the editor of an avant-garde literary magazine, Unearth. His most recent book is a memoir entitled Hand to Mouth, A Chronicle of Early Failure, copies of which will be for sale at the table on the side there after the lecture. In addition to his novels, poetry, and nonfiction, Paul Auster wrote the screenplay for the movie Smoke and co-directed its companion film, Blue in the Face, and he's currently directing a film for which he wrote the screenplay starring Harvey Keitel. And last but not least, he's the youngest author, along with Nabokov, to have his archives resting in the Berg Collection. And actually, they don't rest at all. They get a lot of use. Please welcome Michael Wood and Paul Auster.
Paul, as we've just heard, you're a man of many parts, and you've done and been many things. I mean, just to list them again briefly, you're a poet, you're a novelist, you're a translator, you're an essayist, you're a memoirist, you're an actor, you're a director, you're a screenwriter. You've done all these things, and more than that, there's a lot of diversity inside the diversity. Even within these things you've done, there's a lot of range, so that you're both the author of esoteric poems, interested in esoteric writers, and the author of hard-boiled fiction. So all of this comes under the heading of being a writer. Do you feel any stress here, or is it easy?
The thing to say is I haven't done all those things simultaneously. I mean, the hard-boiled fiction, as I describe in this new book, was written to make some money, and it was like putting a mask on my face. It doesn't mean to say it wasn't enjoyable, but I didn't feel that this was the work I had been put on this earth to do. But it's a way of flexing your muscles. I seem to have moved along and left certain things behind and discovered new things as my life has gone on. As a young person, at the time, in fact, when we met, I should just add that Michael was my teacher at Columbia College when I was a mere boy, 18 or 19 years old, and so we've known each other a long, long time. And in fact, those classes were very important in forming me, in a way. And looking back on it, I don't know if you remember this at all, but you were the first one who got me to read Raymond Chandler, for example. a writer I didn't know at all. He said, you know, why don't you take a look at Chandler? It might interest you. Well, but as a young person, I was interested in all these things at once, the way young people tend to be interested in everything. You know, I was writing poems. I was trying to write fiction as well. But I had a great passionate interest in movies at the same time. And there was a moment in my late teens, early 20s, when I thought, well, maybe I should work in film. That would be a good thing for me to do. But I never did. I got too involved in the writing I was trying to do. I just think, over the years, I wouldn't even talk about progression. It's just moved from one stage to another. And I think one keeps evolving. Who wants to keep writing the same work over and over again? I think the great joy and the great difficulty of writing is pushing yourself in new directions, seeing what you're made of, seeing who you are and what you can do. And so I don't know what's going to happen next. And looking back on what's happened so far, I can only shake my head and wonder how I arrived at these different things.
Sounds like a good cue for going back to the beginning, Paul. In your book, you say you always knew you wanted to write. Your ambition was to write, and you knew this as early as 16 or 17. Mm-hmm. Now, apart from knowing that at 16 or 17, can you say something about what it was you knew? When you wanted to be a writer at 16 or 17, what was that?
Well, that's a great question, because the fact is you have no idea what you want to write about. I mean, you're far too young. Your experiences are far too limited. I think the desire to become a writer comes from reading. And the pleasure one finds in books, and the world that is discovered for you inside literary works. And I can remember very distinctly reading at the age of 15 Crime and Punishment, which to me, well, remains one of the most important experiences of my life. I was flattened by this book. Absolutely.
Where were you?
Home in New Jersey. Uh-huh. You know, Penguin paperback.
Yeah.
I was a high school sophomore.
And you picked it up in a bookstore?
Picked it up in a bookstore, and very small print, David Magershack translation. Uh-huh. I can remember the cover, blue and black. It was a still from the Soviet film of Crime and Punishment. I read it in a kind of fever. And when I finished the book and put it down on the table, I said, if that's what a novel is, if that's what a novel can be, I want to do that too. Right. It was a moment of illumination. Yeah.
There's a moment like that, this is maybe the next moment. In the memoir, you talk about the year between school and college, mm-hmm. between the high school and starting at Columbia College. You take yourself off to Europe, you spend some time in Paris, and you go to Dublin.
Yes.
And you say you go to Dublin because of Joyce.
Yes.
And you have experience in Dublin, which you might like to describe now. But I was also interested, in the same way I'm interested in how you got to the Dostoevsky, how did you get to Joyce? Not every 17-year-old gets to Joyce.
I happened to go to a quite a good public high school in New Jersey with a lot of very bright kids, and a number of us were already writing and reading serious poets and novelists, and it wasn't unusual for people in my little circle to be reading Dubliners and Portrait of the Artist, and So I read those in high school, and then I was on to Ulysses Next, which was the book I carried around with me all summer through Europe. And, you know, the early writers, the ones who made the biggest impressions on me were, I think, Edgar Allan Poe, very young, 11 or 12. I started reading that seriously. But later in adolescence, you know, the great 20th century American writers, Fitzgerald and Hemingway and Faulkner, even John Dos Passos, I liked very much. I was reading everything I could get my hands on in high school.
Do you go back to them, or do you find that as well, being a writer makes you less of a reader?
Well, since then I have gone back to them. Dos Passos with less enthusiasm than I felt before. Hemingway with mixed feelings. At one time I thought he was the greatest writer America had produced. But with a lot of pleasure back to Fitzgerald and Faulkner. But as the years have gone on, I found that I read less and less. And I think... And it's very strange. I was someone who read a book a day. I was always reading something, always tackling something important. And as I began to write fiction more and more and to live inside these imaginary worlds every day of my life, the temptation to enter someone else's imaginary world diminished. And I began to, it's not as though I still don't read novels, but not to the degree I used to. And I tend to read more nonfiction these days and find stimulation in history, for example.
Do you read that with a view to writing? Is that still also, is the reading also part of the writing now?
No, there are books that I'll just pick up out of curiosity, but if something jumps out at me, you know, it's always filed away. You stumble across anecdotes, facts, information that, you know, sometimes will have a use, but I don't plan in the beginning for it to have a use. But as a young writer, it was always surprising to me how when I would meet older writers, how little interest they seemed to have in what was going on in contemporary poetry or contemporary fiction. Whereas, you know, I was greedily devouring all of it. And now, as I'm getting a little long in the tooth myself, I understand that it's going to be very hard at this late stage for me to read a book that will so change my outlook on everything that it will make me a different writer. It's too late, in a way.
I think it reminds me of a conversation I once had with the English poet and critic Donald Davey, who once said to me something very similar to what you said. He said, you know, if I didn't need to read in order to write, I don't think I'd read another book. and I said, actually, I felt exactly the opposite. I don't really want to write books. Books are really just my excuse for reading. I have to do the reading in order to write the book. But the reading is the book is the excuse rather than the... but I think that's interesting. And Paul, when you did begin to write, when you sort of got yourself into writing at a very early stage, you were mainly writing poetry.
Well, I was doing both poetry and fiction. But the fiction didn't satisfy me. So I really showed very little of it to anyone.
What was it like?
Well, it was... it depends on how far back we go.
All the way back.
I think as a teenager, you know, 15, 16, 17, I was writing short stories which were very much influenced by Hemingway or Salinger, a writer I liked very much then, and actually still do. Little stories, nothing very, very down to the ground, so-called realism. As I got older, the fiction began to mutate as I kept reading. So one month, Joyce would be impregnating everything I did. The next month, it would be somebody else. And I think that was the big problem. I hadn't settled yet. There was too much new material coming at me, and I was so impressed with so much that my style, when I got to be, say, about 20 or 21, I was thinking in terms of novels, not short stories. And I would begin in one vein, and by the time I was on page 20, I had read something else which seemed so interesting that I would start to write like somebody else, and it was just a mess.
Because what's interesting, I think, now about the novels is they're very clean. They're the novels of somebody who's read, who makes allusions, who connects things. I'm thinking of the connection to Milton, say, in the City of Glass. But the style itself is not loaded with, is not loaded with voices. It's not haunted in that.
No, I think.
So you must have worked at that.
I worked very hard at
cleaning.
That.
Cleaning.
Yeah, it took a long time to do that. But I should say too, though, even as an undergraduate at Columbia, I started two novels that I wasn't able to finish, and was very dissatisfied with the results at that point. But I didn't let go of them, and one of them became Moon Palace, and the other became In the Country of Last Things. And both those projects were started in my early 20s. It just took a long time to write them.
And what about the poetry book? Because that looks as if it was your main activity.
It was. It was the main activity for about 10 years of my life. I would say it dominated all my efforts as a writer. But I came to a point, and this is very curious, and it's actually the moment when the story in Hand to Mouth ends, mm-hmm. more or less. I came to a moment when I came to a wall, and the poetry was no good anymore. I was repeating myself. Something had happened. Very disturbing, as if all your inspiration, all your ideas had suddenly dried up. There are reasons for it, I'm sure, external reasons, internal reasons, but that was the situation I was in. And that was the period when I wrote the detective novel, just to try to make money, because I was not writing anything that interested me at all. I was throwing it all away. And I really thought that perhaps I was finished as a writer, that I wasn't going to do it anymore. I'd somehow run out of desire, talent, everything, dead. That was 1978, maybe about the summer. And so I didn't write anything at all for maybe 6 months. Then, one night, I think it was in maybe early December, a very old, close, good friend of mine, David Reed, the painter, invited me to go along with him to see the rehearsal of a dance performance that his then-girlfriend had choreographed, a very talented choreographer with her group. And it wasn't the performance, it was just an open rehearsal. She had her dancers on the floor of a gymnasium in a public school in Manhattan somewhere, and with no music, no lighting, no nothing, just the dancers in their sweatsuits doing the motions of each movement of the piece. And then she, the choreographer, would stop them and then talk to the 20 or 30 people who were there. Well, you see, I'm trying to do this with this action. And I was seized with an overwhelming happiness watching this thing, because I found that the dancers were great at what they were doing. It was pure pleasure to watch them, particularly without music. And that her words were so inadequate, were so feeble, so unable to describe the thing I was seeing. It was as almost as if I felt I had walked through some breach, you know, between the world and the word, between language and reality. And it filled me with this tremendous enthusiasm, as if all the weight of the literature I'd been walking around with on my head just fell off. Hard to explain the joy I mm-hmm. felt. And I went home and started writing this little piece, which I wasn't even able to categorize what it was. Poetry, prose, I don't know what it was. A little piece which took me about 2 weeks to write, called White Spaces, which is in book of my selected poems, so it's still there. And I think of that little piece as a bridge into the work I started doing later. Now, the great irony of all this was the last night I worked on that piece, I stayed up very late, just making all the little fine tunings and corrections and then typing the thing up. And it was a Saturday night, and I got to bed around 2 in the morning. The next morning, 7 o'clock, the phone rang, Sunday, very unusual, and there was my uncle on the phone telling me my father had died that night. It's a very eerie business. And really within about 2 or 3 weeks after that, I started writing The Invention of Solitude. But with no literary ambitions anymore, just the desire to do it and let it sound or look the way it looked, and that was all that mattered.
So the track really goes White Spaces, Invention of Solitude, then City of Glass.
Yeah, that's the progression.
Because one of the striking, very beautiful things about this memoir, very understated, but fully involved and implied in what Paul has been saying now, is that on the first page, the person writing this book says he always wanted to be a writer. By the end of the memoir, he describes himself as an ex-writer. But since he's written the memoir, he went to one stage beyond the ex-writer. The French blurb says this is one of the most original and audacious autobiographies ever written by a writer. I was sitting on the train puzzling over this phrase, written by a writer, as distinct from, whatever the alternatives, but it has a meaning.
It has a meaning. Yes, it does. It does. Because I think what he was talking about, if I can remember the context of this, was that I think he was saying no one had ever approached this subject from the point of view of money, this is a book about money, really. An autobiographical essay about money.
Yeah. What you say at one point, Paul, about money is that money, of course, is never just money. And I thought of another thriller writer, not Raymond Chandler, but Ross MacDonald, who says in one of his novels, I don't need any money. Money costs too much.
That's a great one.
And I thought maybe we should talk about say something about the money in this story and how it's never just money.
Well, I think everybody would probably agree with this that we all need money because we couldn't eat without money. We couldn't have a roof over our heads without money. But the desire to have too much money or more money than we need is what probably propels 75% of the actions on Earth. You know, human behavior seems to be motivated by this. And so therefore, I mean, we're talking about psychology. The moment you begin to talk about money, it's not just economics, it's psychology. Right. And this is what's so fascinating about it.
I mean, the context of your remark, Paul, about the money is never just money is the description of your parents, of your mother who loved to spend money and your father who hated to spend money. And you as the child who actually sympathized with both of these positions.
Yes.
Hence the sort of the memoirs about money. It's the memoirs about money, even when it's not about money, isn't it?
Exactly.
I mean, it's even when you're not talking about money, it's still about money.
And that's why, as it kind of weaves around the stories, the other motive in writing this book was, I think, to tell the stories of some of the people that I encountered in my travels. So it's as much about them as about me. But each one seen through the lens of some money problem. For example, the episode about H.L. Humes, that very talented writer who kind of fell on hard times and had conceived a project to destroy the American economy by giving away $50 bills to strangers. This to me is very fascinating, and it somehow connects with the idea of a writer, and it's not unlike the project of Ralph Albert Blakelock, the painter that I'm so fond of, who at a moment just before he went stark raving mad at the turn of the century, because he was a brilliant painter, struggling with 8 or 9 children, he couldn't support them, and he just started making his own money. He would paint money. His portrait would be in the center, you know, like the president, and it would be for a million dollar bill. And he would go into banks trying to cash this money. So.
this is a thing, anyone who's read your fiction, Paul, will have this sense, and this is also something that Luke Sartre says in that little book of pieces about Paul Auster's New York, which is that the and this is true, I think, of any really good writer, that they sign places so that even though you haven't been there, we begin to recognize Paul Auster scenes or Paul Auster people, so we can have Paul Auster experiences even if you didn't write them. That is, so it's a kind of training of the eye or the ear, so you can bump into people. And I think one of the things you always recognize reading, even you only have to read a few pages of any of your work, whether it's memoir or fiction, and you know you're going to meet these people, some kind of people like Teddy and Casey.
Yes.
Or these different people. Say something about Teddy and Casey. Maybe you might just describe them, because they have, in a sense, what's interesting here is that everybody meets such people, but they don't look, and it's not that you see them in a way differently from other people, it's that you seem to have a knack for bumping into more of them.
I guess
than the rest of them.
Is the fate I've been saddled with in my life. Well, Casey and Teddy were two people I met, I think it was the summer after my either freshman or sophomore year at Columbia. And I got a job as a groundskeeper at a hotel in the Borscht Belt. But this was before the season was in full swing. There were no guests in the hotel, it was just empty. And we were preparing the grounds for the summer season. And I went up with a friend of mine. We got the job through the New York State Employment Agency here. And most of the people working there at that time were Bowery bums, drifters, people without any regular employment. And two of them, Casey and Teddy, were a pair. They were friends, a dynamic duo. They went everywhere together. They were American drifters in the old style. One of them was black, Teddy, and the other one was white, Casey. Now, they weren't gay. They were interested in women, but they were just buddies, and they did everything together, everything the same. So, for example, on their day off, they would go into town together, and they would get identical haircuts and identical shirts. They'd come back, you know, proudly showing off their new clothing. And they were wonderful and funny, and Teddy particularly. He was the comic, and Casey was more the straight man, maybe because he had no sense of taste or smell. Casey had been hit in the face in a barroom brawl some years before and had lost his sense of taste. And Teddy drank a little too much. And I can remember one afternoon that's still vividly etched in my mind. It was a long ballroom. I mean, it's as big as this room, maybe even bigger. And completely empty, and there was a piano at the end, maybe where that camera is. And he just kind of staggered drunkenly, sun coming through the windows to the piano, and he was completely soused. And he said, "Now I'm going to play my port wine concerto." And he just started banging away, you know, the most awful music. But he was just as happy as could be.
You have a great phrase in there about it. It's about something about him, about a kind of appetite for getting into trouble.
Yes.
You say,
yes.
No reason. It wasn't sort of destructive or anarchic,
no,
but just a kind of appetite for trouble.
Challenging everybody, right. making scenes wherever he went. I could remember a time we all went out, my friend and I, and then Casey and Teddy went out to a restaurant in town because the food became so awful. They fed us chicken chow mein out of a can every single meal, breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And so we couldn't take it anymore. We decided to go to a restaurant off the grounds of the hotel. And I think it was just some kind of delicatessen. And Teddy started reading the menu, and he suddenly became very outraged. And he stood up and said, "I ain't eating this Japanese dog food." And, you know, there was a big come out. He nearly got arrested. So Casey was always getting him to come down.
There are a lot. I mean, it's important, isn't it, that these stories. You say somewhere, I think, maybe in the Music of Chance, that it's important that these stories don't have a meaning.
Yes.
That is that the coincidence. That is the they feel loaded with meaning. They feel freighted with all kinds of interesting aura, edge, but they actually don't make a meaning. They can't be moralized or allegorized.
I think once you do that, you get in very dangerous territory. Yeah. And I've tried to resist this. Every once in a while, one is tempted to start reading bigger implications into events, and I think that way lies fanaticism and stupidity.
Yeah. Yeah. You have a great phrase. So I think this is in The Invention of Solitude. You talk about the anecdote as a form of knowledge, but I think we could add to that the anecdote is a form of knowledge only on condition that you don't really try and cash it in as knowledge. I mean, you have to. It's knowledge only as long as it remains anecdote.
Exactly.
Once you turned it into something, paraphrase, translation, moral, fable, point of the story, you'd have lost it.
But this is the power of story. You see, it's something that is irreducible, and so if it's pregnant with implication, meaning, beauty, emotion, whatever, it's something you can keep chewing on for the rest of your life. If you can solve it too easily, if you can just summarize in a neat phrase, well, this means that, and therefore this, then it goes away. But it's the things that we don't understand, that we can't make full sense of, that continue to stay with us, and I think inform our lives and help us to live.
Particularly when they feel as if they're loaded with sense. That is, that there's plenty of just ordinary meaningless stuff around, but stuff that feels as if it's got... It's about to tell you something. And with a lot of moments in Proust like this, where he's on the edge of a revelation, but actually the revelation is only there on condition that it doesn't really happen. You get the feeling of the revelation.
Absolutely.
There is no revelation to be.
Well, I've been quite interested, I was to say, the last 5 years in writing true stories, these little anecdotes, a couple of those, Red Notebook or Why Write Art, true stories. But there are some that I'm still not sure what to do with, stories that move me very much, but I haven't found a way to write them. For example, see what you make of this story. And this was told to me by someone I think is a reliable person, and I believe it to be a true story. During World War II, there was a German Jewish woman with a son. And the Nazis came in, took over her town. She said to herself, I'm not leaving. This is my country, and I refuse to give in, and I'm going to somehow take care of myself. She sent her son to America. And years went by. She somehow, by some miracle, managed to survive the war by hiding out with friends and people who took care of her. The son... became a doctor in the United States. He went to college and medical school. And they hadn't seen each other in years. The war ended, and arrangements were made for her to come to America to see him. And he was living in Boston. He was going to pick her up at the airport. But at the appointed time, an emergency operation, there was some emergency at the hospital. He had to go and perform surgery on someone. So he went to the hospital, and a taxi driver was sent to the airport to pick up the mother, who arrived on time, gets into the cab, and the taxi is driving back to Boston, and is a terrible accident. And the woman is gravely wounded. And the next time the son saw her was in the hospital as she's being wheeled in, as he's going right after he just finished surgery, was going to meet his mother at the apartment, and there's his mother being wheeled in, and she died in the hospital. So this is a true story, but I don't know, I haven't been able to tell it or make sense of it yet. It's too terrible, isn't it?
Yeah.
But it's true.
Yeah. Yeah, it's too terrible. It's full of the elements of plot, isn't it?
Yes.
It's full of the elements, the ingredients of something, but actually, it'd be too easy to overdo it.
Right.
too easy to get to some sort of easy irony or
that's right.
Melodrama.
That's right.
Yeah, I think so. The other great theme in the memoir, Hand to Mouth, Paul, which is it's in the title, but is, again, like the question of money, is worked through in a very subtle way, is the theme of failure.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you get from reading this book is a sense that failure is not as easy as it looks. That's
a very interesting comment, and I'm sure you're right about that, okay. Too. Yeah. But I remember reading the phrase, you know, as a young person, at the moment I began reading Beckett seriously, he said, to be an artist is to fail, as no other dare fail.
Yeah.
And I think that made a deep and lasting impression on me.
Yeah.
And he's right.
He's right. And they're very interesting. I mean, the theme of failure works through this book in all kinds of interesting ways, related to money, related to obsessions. I particularly like the bit about the Christopher Smart Prize.
Yes.
At Columbia. Do you want to say something about the founding of the Christopher Smart Prize?
Actually, maybe I could read it, because it's I think I have my glasses here. This was something I cooked up as an undergraduate, and it might be... Okay. Let's see. Okay. Well, this is part of a passage about my college days. I can think of several examples of this antic bumbling, but the one that best captures the spirit of the time was a little piece of jabberwocky I contributed to the Columbia Review, the undergraduate literary magazine. For reasons that utterly escape me now, I took it upon myself to launch the first annual Christopher Smart Award. I was a senior then, and the contest rules were published on the last page of the fall issue. I plucked these sentences from the text at random. The purpose of the award is to give recognition to the great anti-men of our time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It was to reward failure. The object of the competition was to reward failure, not common everyday setbacks and stumbles, but monumental falls, gargantuan acts of self-sabotage. In other words, I wanted to single out the person who had done the least with the most, who had begun with every advantage, every talent, every expectation of worldly success, and had come to nothing. Contestants were asked to write an essay of 50 words or more describing their failure or the failure of someone they knew. The winner would receive a 2-volume box set of Christopher Smart's collected works. To no one's surprise but my own, not one entry was submitted.
That's a great story.
Christopher Smart, in case you don't know, was an 18th century English poet and really a genius, but he had mental problems, drinking problems, and never really amounted to what people thought he might have amounted to.
That's a great choice. And the other sort of major piece of this book is the baseball game that you invented, Paul. I mean, you could say more about the baseball game, but what struck me about it was in a way the baseball game itself was interesting. This is a way of making money through selling a baseball game.
Yeah.
The baseball game itself is interesting, but what is much more interesting is your account of your own amazing dogged persistence.
Yes.
With this totally hopeless project. So there's a kind of the dedication with
yes.
which you stuck to it.
It's
really interesting, I think.
I thought it was going to work, you see. I didn't want to give up too quickly. To fill in the background of this, during the darkest moments of my life at that time, I conceived of this idea I invented a card game that was a baseball game. And I thought I would be able to sell it to a company and perhaps they could manufacture it, and then every time they sold a game, I would get a little royalty, and it would help me and my family to
live. Just like writing a book, really.
Yeah, yeah. Writing a book. But this was with cards. And so I worked it all out, and I made the cards by hand in 4 different colors. And it's really quite ingenious in its own way. But when I tried to interest companies in it, I got absolutely nowhere. But one person would lead me to another, and I had enough little sparks of hope to keep me going way past the time I should have stopped. So The game is in here too. Yeah.
The game is also in the book, so you could buy the book, you could play the game. You know, maybe make some money.
Right.
But I think this is very much the theme of this thing, and it's very similar to themes that come up in your fiction too. A perfectly reasonable, or well, let's not say perfectly reasonable, but a not totally unreasonable
right.
scheme for making money turns into something which one can't let go of.
Yeah.
Whereas where the money is still the notional reason for going on, it's the story one tells oneself about why one's doing this, but actually something much more deeply obsessive.
It becomes
and
an
clinging.
It's
is
an
going
aesthetic
on.
Experience. Right. You right. see that right. that's. Right. I became very attached to my game. I thought there was some beautiful symmetry to it, and I wanted to see if I could get anyone else to think what I was thinking. Right. Right. Obviously, I couldn't, but right. I wanted to try. Right. And but I've seen. See, if we talk about, how shall I say? The money impulse underlying everything that goes on in the world, even at times aesthetic impulses, mm-hmm. I also believe the reverse is yeah. true, that there is an aesthetics of money, too, and that sometimes, I, for example, you know, having now worked in films a bit, the producer that I work with is a very fine, wonderful, honest, straight, terrific person, has the love of the perfect deal that a poet would have in a well-formed sonnet. Mm. He could say, look how clean it is, you know, and he would show me the pyramid, how everyone will get something. and this is not, he's not thinking how much money I'm going to make. He's thinking, what a beautiful thing I've created.
Yeah,
how symmetrical. And so that's, you know, the aesthetic impulse underlying business.
Yeah. And there's also an impulse, which there's a great sentence here. It's one of the sentences that surprised me most in this book. Not because the sentence itself surprised me, but because it doesn't come out where I think it's going to come out. It has to do, I think, with there's money underlying aesthetics, there's aesthetics underlying money, and there's a kind of interest in the truth, however ugly, which gets us, whether mm-hmm. we want to or not. Mm-hmm. This is the sentence. This is when Paul was working on an oil tanker for Esso, about the ugliness of the port, the ugliness
right.
of the life. This is how the sentence begins, and I'll say how I thought it was going to end. It begins, the ugliness was so universal, so deeply connected to the business of making money, and the power that money bestowed on the ones who made it. At this point, I'm already reading the end of the sentence as that I was really disgusted. Uh-huh. At this point, uh-huh. I decided I was going to quit. I had to go home. I couldn't take it any longer. This is the way the sentence goes. I'll start again. It goes, the ugliness was so universal, so deeply connected to the business of making money, and the power that money bestowed on the ones who made it, even to the point of disfiguring the landscape, of turning the natural world inside out, that I began to develop a grudging respect for it.
Well, again, it's the idea triumphant.
Yeah.
The idea as power, in a way.
Yeah, yeah. It is. It's the real idea.
And this is how the world yeah. works. Yeah. And so you have to respect it, because if you don't, then you're not even living in the real world
right.
at all.
Right. Right. That's very good. No. And the real world has a claim.
It certainly does.
Aesthetic and other claims.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The other thing, I found myself thinking, reading about the baseball game, Paul, I found myself thinking about the music of chance. And your whole interest in games and chance. I know you don't like talking about interpreting novels in this way, but how does this, does that run on your mind? I mean, how does that, is there a lineage then?
I'm not sure. The funny thing is, I'm not very involved in games. This
right.
this is the great irony of both that novel. I'm not a big poker player,
right.
and I'm not a big game player, even though I invented a game. And I have very little patience for games.
So something in the idea of the game, though.
That's right. I think it was inventing the game that was interesting, but actually playing it is not as much fun for me. Very strange. But I get bored. I'm very bad at crossword puzzles, very bad at Scrabble. I get bored very quickly.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah. That's interesting. Do you want to say something? The other thing, this brings us to, also in this book, there are three plays. There is the baseball game, and there is a hard-boiled detective novel, which you give away the solution at the beginning, isn't it?
That yes.
It looks like a murder, but it turns out to be a suicide.
Right.
Unlike all those suicides that turn out to be.
Right.
That doesn't seem like a winning idea, really.
No, I'm sure not.
Right. But
it didn't get me very far. I'll tell you.
But there does seem to me a real relation between the hard work, the detective novel here, Squeeze Play and City of Glass, that you are on your way to something there. I know the eventual solitude comes between, but I seem to see that detective novel with some, I don't know, if the detectives could get to read Beckett, they could enter the world of City of Glass.
It's possible. The difference is, I was trying to imitate a tone in this book, and with the other, I wasn't. The other difference is, of course, there's a solution to this mystery, whereas the other book just opens up more questions. But it is, nevertheless, the first novel I wrote, the first finished novel. Mm-hmm. And I think just being able to do it, hack work though it might have been, you know, motivated by money as it might have been, I think it proved to me that I had it in me to write a novel. And that probably helped. And the experience of writing a novel under a pseudonym, I think, helped me to understand Quinn, the hero of City of Glass.
Yeah, I was going to suggest it may be that writing in other voices, even writing pastiche, even writing material that you yourself are not identified with, may do more for you as a writer than the writer can be fully aware of. I'm thinking now of also there's a story, you tell a story here about the movie script.
Yes.
The movie treatment, which you write by, you know, culling every cliche you can find.
That's right.
And the story then becomes of, you know, the guy says, this is just what he wants. I thought it was going to be too literary, but it turns out to have every cliche. But there is also a skill to doing that. And in a way, these worlds are probably not as disconnected as they seem to the writer at the time.
No, probably not.
There's probably some traffic.
And, you know, being a novelist is being able to mimic things anyway. And it's probably... writing a pastiche like that is probably not unlike translation as an exercise for a young writer.
Yeah.
It takes some of the pressure off,
and
I think it's probably a good thing.
And so it frees you up for other things.
It frees you up to explore language in ways that are liberating rather than constraining.
Yeah. Out that you find this book. One of the difficulties for, and I remember this when, you know, when we talk about writing, you know, years ago in the 60s, one of the difficulties for young writers, I think, is not that they take themselves too seriously. I mean, many people take themselves, young and old, take themselves too seriously. Mm-hmm. But the problem with young writers is not they take themselves seriously, but they take writing too seriously.
Yeah.
As if it didn't need play or imitation of pastiche, as if every word had to count in some rather solemn way. And that, I think, always produces dead.
Yes.
Dead writing.
Yes.
The writing has to have some sense of escape, and some, you know, something. I don't know what the word is, but some sense that frivolity is not impossible here.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. It's got to be alive. Unpredictable.
Yeah. Paul, the movie Smoke came out of a story you wrote, a Christmas story. Say something about how that occurred and how you got yourself into your present fix of directing a movie.
Well. The story was commissioned by someone at the New York Times, Mike Levitas, who ran the op-ed page back then. This was about 7 years ago. And he called me up out of the blue one day and said, I have an idea. Why don't we have a Christmas story on the op-ed page on Christmas Day? And why don't you write it? And I thought, wow, no one has ever asked me to write anything before, certainly not a work of fiction. And so I was very interested, but I didn't have any ideas at all. And there were only a few days. I had to give him an answer within 2 or 3 days. And just as I was about to call and say I just can't think of anything, I looked at the little tin of cigars that I, Schimmelpenix, little things I like to smoke, and started thinking about the man in Brooklyn who sold them to me and the kind of relationship we had, which was very warm, very friendly, but we weren't friends, we didn't know anything about each other. These kinds of relations you have in a big city. And I began reflecting on this, and the story began to develop in my mind. So I published that story. Wayne Wang, the director, lives in San Francisco, stumbled across it on Christmas Day and thought, interesting idea for a film, and contacted me, and I said to him, fine, go ahead and make a film. And I wasn't very interested in getting involved, but little by little, Wayne drew me into the process. It's too complicated, it would take too long to tell all the details. But I wound up writing the screenplay, and then once the screenplay was done, he kept drawing me further in, so that in the end we made these two films together. We were.
How did the second film come out of the first?
The second film came out of.
This is Blue in the Face, is this?
Blue in the Face. After it came out of the rehearsals for Smoke. We had the luxury of quite extended rehearsal time for Smoke, and at one point, Harvey Keitel and Giancarlo Esposito and some of the other people I called the OTB men in the script, the guys who hang around the store, came in to work up their parts and get to know each other in their roles. And Wayne and I were in a little room with them. They said, can we improvise a little bit just to warm up? And of course, that was fine. And they did things that day that were so funny and so unexpected that Wayne, in a burst of enthusiasm, turned to me and said, you know, we should make another movie after Smoke. Just go back into the cigar store for a couple of days and turn on the cameras and see what these people can do. And that was the seed of it. So it grew from there. It was this producer I was talking about before, Peter Newman, who got so excited about the idea that he found the money for it. He said, it's like turning over the asylum to the inmates. That's what I think.
And then how did the current film?
The current film grew up. It wasn't in my plans, you know, to keep working in movies.
Are you working on another novel?
I've been working on another novel. Yes, that's been going on. But how shall I put it? There was a story that occurred to me as we were finishing up Smoke and Blue in the Face. We were in post-production, and I saw the story as a film. And I said to myself, no, I don't want to do this anymore. I'm too tired. I just want to go back into my room and work on my book. And I thought, well, this story does grip me. Maybe it could be a novel. This is a fatal mistake. You should never betray your original impulse about a work. And I spent about 9 months working on this story as a novel. And I didn't like it at all. It just wasn't working because it had a certain kind of visual component to it that just would make it much better as a film. So I put the thing away. And at some point, maybe 6 months or a year after that, a friend of mine, a director, said, you know, he had been trying to do something. It's so complicated because I don't want to name any names. It gets too complicated with an actress to do some kind of new version of the Lulu plays. And it started me thinking about this novel that I had given up. Mm-hmm. And there was always a moment in the story when the main character meets a young woman, a young actress, who acts in a film. Now, I hadn't gotten to the point in the novel where the film had to be described yet. And I had several different ideas. I was toying with different ideas. And I thought, what if the film she does is Pandora's Box? Will this work or won't it work? And I started fiddling with it, and then I got sucked into it again because it did seem to work. And then I wrote this screenplay.
As a screenplay?
Just as a screenplay. And I was going to give it to my friend to direct. But then, for very complicated reasons, he couldn't do it. And then I thought, well, who should I give this screenplay to? And I couldn't come up with a good idea. And I thought, well, I'll do it myself because I know the script. It's my story. Maybe I should just give it a try. And so that's where I am now. We're preparing to make this film.
What's it called?
It's called Lulu on the Bridge.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Terrific.
Yeah.
I think if the anecdote is a form of knowledge, we've filled ourselves with knowledge this evening.
Yeah.
So I'd like to thank you very much.
If we, right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
I guess we can go. Thank you.